Thanks very much, and it's just a pleasure to be here with the, as the French say, les purs et les durs. The last stragglers, the inhabitants of the deep minds, any event, to talk about an extremely important topic. Our work, this presentation is based on a book which appeared last year about this time called Entropy Economics, Living Basis of Value in Production. And I'm here with my co-author, Jing Chen. If you could just stand, Jing, and over so that say hi. That's a real privilege to be have a chance to speak to these questions on this occasion. Our approach to providing a theory of value and a theory of production on the basis of principles that have been familiar and actually considered universal in physics and biology for well over a century, but which have somehow escaped the attention of economists, is one which is well adjusted, I think, to discussing the question of economic power. And so I will just start by giving you a sense of the everybody knows to be, in some sense, the standard vision of the dominant strain of thought in our profession. I call it the textbook view, which, generally speaking, begins with a discussion of exchange of entities, commodities, products, which have previously been produced. And the focus of the institutional focus of the exchange process is obviously the market, which is considered to be efficient, except when there's market failure, which there always is, but you don't get to that until the 10th or 11th week of the semester, and it's quite quickly forgotten because the holidays are coming up by the time it comes around to discuss it. Power, as I think we all recognize, does not play an important role because the ideal arrangement in the market structure is competitive, and that rules out the accumulation of power from the beginning. Regulations are there to address the market failures when they occur. Now, production does occur in the system, and you get to it about 4 or 5 weeks into the course, but it's a derivative activity, and it's also considered to happen as a result of market processes. And so we have these completely misleading metaphors of the labor market, the capital market, which actually do not exist in the real world, but provide a convenient way of not thinking about how power relations are actually structured. And of course, at the end of the day, the market processes are supposed to tend toward an equilibrium, which is then stable until it's disturbed, which is why the standard let's say, way of thinking in our profession is never prepared for a financial crisis or recession or any other instability which is endemic to the system under which we live. Okay. What do we offer as an alternative? First of all is that in order to have anything to exchange, you have first to produce it. And so one has to consider that production, not exchange, is the central economic activity. And all production requires resources. And the higher the quality or the lower the entropy of those resources, the better you are, better off you are. Resources must be extracted, and they must be extracted with a surplus, which is to say there's got to be something left over after you have put the capital to work and the labor to work in order to get the coal out of the ground or the oil out of the tar sands or out of the Orinoco Basin or wherever it happens to be, the Permian Basin. There has to be some energy left over that can be put to use. In order to do that, you have to have made fixed investments, and fixed investments are always made according to plans. So there is no way in our system for economic activity to occur in a serious way unless it is planned for and invested in order to make it achieve. Inequalities are a necessary feature of any useful work. That is to say, this is Carnot's principle, the foundation of thermodynamics. And that's true with their physical systems and economic systems, temperature, pressure, but also income and wealth. And the thing about inequalities is that they have to be regulated, otherwise your engine blows up, your reactor melts down, your banking system collapses, and those of us who are of a certain age, our blood pressure begins to affect our health. All of that is a process which, in a sense, you have a necessity of inequality, but a necessity of also of regulation. And finally, the more complicated, the more advanced, the more efficient your system. But it is an unavoidable fact that the more complicated and advanced the system, the larger the scale of fixed investment, then more fragile and more likely it is to be afflicted by crises, and nothing escapes that in the long run. Well, thanks to really insights that are associated with Ching Chen has instructed me on over the years, it's possible to represent this, represent the foundations of a theory of value in an extremely simple way. And we do that with a very straightforward expression, a logarithm function, which has an argument that's related to the scarcity, the probability or the scarcity of a commodity, and a base which measures the degree of market power by simply taking the number of suppliers of a commodity as the base of the logarithm. And then if you go over a series of processes or products, you can just sum up and get the average, and you can see the second expression, which is identical to an information theoretic expression for entropy, which is why we call this entropy economics. So this is something which brings an economic theory very much into line with Claude Shannon's information theory and with other theories that are relevant to the physical and biological world, and also necessarily very close to Henri Theil's measures of inequality, which I have used very extensively in a whole body of research related to the measurement of inequality. If you put this into, just crank out the numbers, you get a relationship between the probabilities or scarcities in economic value. The more scarce a commodity, or then the higher its economic value. Eventually, as a commodity moves through the life cycle of production, it becomes, generally speaking, ubiquitous. Its economic value tends to decline towards zero. Similarly, as you add suppliers, quite quickly, the degree of market power concludes. So in order to maximize your economic value, and it is helpful to be in the production of a new and different product, which is necessarily scarce, and to have a monopoly position. And the more you can maintain that monopoly position, the longer you can maintain an advantage in terms of the economic value extracted. Well, what's the role of resources here? High quality resources, when abundant, have low economic value, but they are the foundation of activities that generate economic value. Food, which is frequently subsidized, is a nice example of that. Energy and rare earths are another, and those two feed a system that generates new technologies, products, weapons, which are scarce and valuable. And as a result of that, naturally, the control of resource-producing regions is a key to the wealth of those that do not have high-quality resources immediately at hand. Some very current examples come immediately to mind. China controls the refining of rare earths, which are actually not themselves rare, and the production of gallium, which is a byproduct of refining bauxite into alumina. Gallium is indispensable for advanced and particularly military uses of microelectronics. This monopoly gives China the ability to specify the terms of trade and other policies, including security policies, to the United States. And it was a realization of this fact in recent months, which has led to the trade truce that has occurred between China and the United States after a rather aggressive and set of actions that started off the second Trump administration. Here's another example, the armaments trade. Typically, we tend to think of armaments, if we think of them at all, as being something that's produced by a country to advance national power. But this is particularly the case if the country is the major buyer and therefore controls the market for their armaments, one buyer and only, and several or many producers. But in the modern Western system, and particularly the NATO countries, armaments producers differentiate their weapons, and they do this in order to lock in a larger customer base. And as a result of that, instead of having one buyer and many sellers, you have one seller and potentially many buyers, and the power is transferred from the country to the companies, with the result that economic value passes to the contractor. This is not the case in Russia, or for that matter, China, these days, where the production of weapons remains largely dominated by the state, and the products are much more plentiful and produced at a much lower cost. And here's another example which comes directly from the book, I added the caption, e.g., the United States and Venezuela this morning, because it captures very well the processes of market integration between a resource-poor region with a large market size, the United States, resource-rich region with a small market size, let's call it Venezuela. You can see the measure of scarcity on that diagram, and what happens is that that leads to a high value for the product, which we call it oil, in the resource-poor region, a very low value in the resource-rich region. And when you bring the two together, the value of the product in the resource-rich region declines and goes up in the resource-poor region, which is good for the consumers in the rich region and the producers in the poor region. Consumers in the resource-poor region, producers in the resource-rich region. And of course, that raises the question of who's going to control production and for what purpose. Which I suppose, if in fact the United States has taken over is taking over the oil production in Venezuela, we will soon discover whether the purpose of this was to lower the prices for consumers or raise them for producers by taking Venezuelan oil actually off the market. And we do not know the answer to that, and we may not find out because we do not know the extent to which the U.S. is actually going to end up controlling that market. That's at least a way of applying this method in a very direct and concrete way, which was published before the events of the last few days, to analyze the consequences of taking what were essentially separated production processes and processes of control and bringing them back into a single integrated market. Here's another example, and it's the last one I will offer this afternoon. It's a little bit of excursion into the economics of divide and rule. And this again directly from the book. But let's just suppose that we have a population, 10% of it is upper class, 30% are middle class, 60% are lower class, and you have a two-party system, which is why the base of the logarithm in this case is 2. You can just calculate out a measure of the economic power or the political power of members of each of these groups. The value of an upper class person comes out to about 3.3, of a middle class 1.7, and a lower class person 0.74. So the power differential between the upper and lower class person is about 5. Now suppose, we argue, that you decide that you're in the upper class and you have control over these things, you'd merge the middle and lower classes by increasing taxes on the middle and subsidies on the lower, and now you've got two classes, one of which has 10% and the other which has 90% of the population. The economic power of the upper class individual remains the same. That of any single member of the other class has now been reduced by a substantial amount. And in fact, the ratio has gone up from 5 to about 22, so that the power associated with being a member of the upper class now outweighs the numerical advantage of the lower group. But then suppose you complement this with a policy of divide and rule, that is to say, create a set of divisions within the lower middle class based on whatever criteria you might choose, religion, race, national origin, whatever it might be, gender identity. And now you have, let's say, 10 such distinct and mutually hostile groups, and the power of the individual in the lower group is now not based on the logarithm base 2, but now 10, and it reduces it by another significant factor of 3, to 0.05, excuse me, and the differential goes up to 66. This is just a way of saying that you can take the mathematical structure that we present in this book and use it to illustrate the fact that we all know, which is that divide and rule is an extremely effective manner for controlling, for a minority to control the activities of a majority. So it's not telling you anything you didn't already know, but it is telling you that you can represent it according with this method in a very simple, straightforward, and I think intuitive way. So let's see. General conclusions, I don't think I really need to restate them, but these are foundational concepts. They are rooted in real-world conditions, which include the distribution of power, a topic which has been neglected deliberately in mainstream economics. They're closely tied to resource quality and the development of technologies. This is very closely associated with ideas that have been expressed in the past by Veblen and by Schumpeter, by my father and others. They describe how economic processes work through time and in a system which is inherently unstable and where there's no such thing as a long-term equilibrium, so that even if you like the system, the best you can hope for is to keep it going for a certain period of time, and good luck. If you'd like to read more, the book is available, and I would be very happy, and Jing and I would both be very happy to have your comments on this work. Thank you for your attention to this matter.